Meeting will come to order.
Chair now recognizes the ranking member or their counsel for the first round of their 45-minute questions.
Thank the gentleman. I want to get a few basic facts on the table of individuals that were involved in the 2016 election, just to see who you know and who you've met with. So I'll start with you, Mr. Holmes. Have you met with or do you know Alexandra Chalupa?
Thank you. Holmes, could you put your microphone on?
No.
Do you know Nellie Orr? You met with Nellie Orr? Bruce Orr?
No.
Glenn Simpson?
No.
Thank you. Same question for you, Dr. Hill. Do you know or have you met with Alexandra Chalupa?
No.
Nellie Orr?
No.
Bruce Orr?
Only in the course of my previous position as the National Intelligence Officer for Russia, where he attended some of the meetings that I presided over.
Years ago?
That's a long time ago, correct.
Glenn Simpson?
No.
Dr. Hill, in your testimony, you said that, in your deposition, excuse me, that Christopher Steele was your counterpart at one time. Is this correct?
That's correct, yes.
You testified that you met with Christopher Steele in 2016. I assume that's still correct?
That's correct, yes.
And the only thing we didn't get on that is, do you know about when that was in 2016 and how many times?
I'm afraid I don't. I actually had met with him, well, you asked me actually in the deposition when the most recent time that I had met with him in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And he retired from the British Intelligence Services in 2009, which is
right,
the same
I'm
time.
I'm asking about 2016.
2016, I don't recall, but I did meet with him some times before 2016.
But you don't remember the date?
I don't, I'm afraid, no.
Okay. You stated in your deposition that a colleague had showed you the Steele dossier before it was published. Who was that colleague?
That was one of my colleagues at the Brookings Institution.
And who was that?
That was the Brookings Institution President Strobe Talbot, who had been sent a copy of this.
And he shared it with you?
That was the day before it was published in BuzzFeed.
Thank you. You mentioned in your deposition also that you thought that it was a... Let's get the exact quote, that the dossier was a rabbit hole. Is that still your testimony?
That's correct.
Do you know who paid Christopher Steele to do, to generate the Steele dossiers? There were several of them.
At the time, I did not know. I understand from the media that it was through GPS Fusion. If that's not correct,
You know who was, and there was a law firm involved, but you know who the source of the money was?
I didn't at the time. No, I did not.
But do you know?
Well, now I've read it in reports, and thanks to your colleagues as well, that it was the DNC, as I'm led to believe.
And the Clinton campaign?
I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Mr. Castor.
Good afternoon. Welcome back from lunch. Hope you had some sandwiches or something delicious.
Hope you did, too.
Dr. Hill, thank you for your service. Also, thank you for your participation in the deposition on October 14th, Columbus Day. We were with you most of the day, so I appreciate that. Mr. Holmes, thank you as well. You're a late entrant into this situation, and things sure did escalate quickly. We spoke with you last Friday night about what we thought was going to be a 30-second vignette about a two-minute phone call, and it turns out you know with your 40-minute opener today, you have a lot of information to share. So we appreciate you being here, Dr. Hill. Your last day at the National Security Council was July 19th. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
So you were involved with the July 25th call, and you weren't involved with any of the relevant activities related to the pause in the aid.
I was not. That's correct.
And as of July 19th, did you believe that a call was going to be scheduled for the 25th?
I personally did not believe that it was going to be scheduled that day, no.
And what was the thinking at the NSC as of July 19th about such a call?
Well, I've learned from other depositions to be clear here that perhaps there was some awareness that there might be a call. Ambassador Sondland, if you may recall, showed an exchange with the person who was taking over from my position, Tim Morrison, in which he indicated that there would be a call coming up. I was not aware of that.
Okay. Were you in favor?
So there were differences, let's just say, obviously, in understanding about that call.
And were you in favor of such a call as of the 19th?
Actually, I was not, and I did say something about that in the opening part of the sessions today.
Okay. And how about Ambassador Bolton, to your knowledge?
Well, I know that Ambassador Sondland said in that email that Bolton was in agreement. To my knowledge, Bolton was not in agreement at that particular juncture,
and
to my knowledge.
Do you know what his opposition was?
It was based on the fact that he didn't feel the call had been properly prepared, and as I said earlier, that we wanted to make sure that there was going to be a fulsome bilateral U.S.-Ukraine agenda that was discussed, which is usual with these calls.
And were you surprised that a call ultimately was scheduled?
I was when I learned about it, that's right.
And did you have any communications with anyone back at your old staff with about how that came to be?
I did not, no.
Okay. You did learn about the pause in the security assistance aid.
I learned about that on July 18th, so the day before I left, that's
okay.
Correct.
And there were several meetings about this, I believe you testified to.
I said that I knew there was going to be a meeting in that time frame, and there was one put onto the schedule for the following week, but of course I had left, and so I didn't attend that.
And is it fair to say that it stops and starts in aid like this sometimes do happen?
That's correct.
And I believe you testified that there was a freeze put on all kinds of aid and assistance because it was in the process. At that time, there were significant reviews of foreign assistance going on?
That's also correct, yes.
And what else can you tell us about that?
About the foreign assistance review? As I understood, there had been a directive for a whole-scale review of our foreign policy assistance and the ties between our foreign policy objectives and the assistance. This had been going on actually for many months. And in the period when I was wrapping up my time there, there had been more scrutiny than specific assistance to specific sets of countries as a result of that overall view review.
And at this time as well, Ambassador Volker and Ambassador Sondland, they had become a little bit more involved with Ukraine policy?
Well, Ambassador Volker was always involved in Ukraine policy, at least since the beginning of his appointment as the special envoy for negotiations towards the war between Ukraine and Russia in Donbass.
What can you tell us about Ambassador Volker?
Ambassador Volker is an extraordinarily accomplished diplomat. I've worked with him in many capacities previously. You know his bio. He's been the ambassador to NATO. He's had a number of positions at the State Department, and actually I know him personally. So, you know, in the truth that we're trying to get at it, who knows who and who's met. I know Ambassador Volker really well on a personal level as well.
Okay. And you said he's a man of integrity.
That's correct.
And always acted in the best interest of the United States?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you first learn of Ambassador Sondland's involvement?
Well, it came in different ways. Ambassador Sondland, as the ambassador to the EU, had some perfectly logical involvement in the Ukraine portfolio. We work very closely with the European Union on matters related to Ukraine. The Ukrainian dialogue with Russia was in a format known as the Minsk process, which was led by the French and the Germans, and Ambassador Volker was trying to find out ways in which he could work closely with the French and Germans to move along on the resolution of the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. And obviously the European Union, as the umbrella organization for Europe in terms of funding and assistance, was heavily active in offering financial assistance to the Ukrainian government as well as humanitarian assistance in the conflict. So it's perfectly logical that Ambassador Sondland would play some kind of role as our ambassador to the European Union.
Did you have any concerns when he presented himself to you as somebody with a major role?
I did at the time in which he presented it to me. This was after Ambassador Yovanovitch had been pushed out of her position. And it was at that juncture that Ambassador Sondland's role seemed to grow larger.
And did you express any concerns to him directly?
I did express concerns to him directly.
What were those concerns?
I asked him quite bluntly in a meeting that we had in June of 2019. So this is after the presidential inauguration, when I'd seen that he had started to step up in much more of a proactive role on Ukraine. You know, what was his role here? And he said that he was in charge of Ukraine. And I said, well, who put you in charge, Ambassador Sondland? And he said, the president.
And did that surprise you when he told you that?
It did surprise me. We'd had no directive. We hadn't been told this. Ambassador Bolton had never indicated in any way that he thought that Ambassador Sondland was playing a leading role in Ukraine.
Right. I believe you used the term a large remit, that he characterized he had been given a large remit from the president.
I can't remember what I said, remit, but it was portfolio. He was constantly, you know, these are all synonyms. He was talking to us about the fact that he'd been given a very broad portfolio by the president. He said his job was to go out and make deals in Europe. And as you know yourself, I listened to his testimony yesterday very carefully as well. He said that anything that had to do with the EU itself and the European Union member states was within his portfolio.
Right. We asked Ambassador Sondland about that at his deposition, and he conceded that he may have been spinning a little bit when he said that the president specifically gave him that role, and he indicated that his authority was coming at least a little bit from, more from the Secretary of State. At any point in time, was that related to you?
At different points, he mentioned talking directly to the Chief of Staff Mulvaney, and he also talked about Secretary Pompeo. But he was very, in fact, there were other people in the room in the meeting in which he asserted this to me, that it was the President who had put him in charge of this.
Were you encouraged as of your last day in the office that U.S. policy towards the Ukraine was headed in the right direction?
I was not.
And why was that?
Well, I was concerned about two things in particular. One was, again, the removal of our ambassador. And again, I will say for the record that the president has a perfect right to remove any ambassador at any time for any reason. But I was very concerned about the circumstances in which her reputation had been maligned repeatedly on television and in all kinds of exchanges. I felt that that was completely unnecessary. If the president wanted to remove an ambassador, which he did quite frequently, there was a number of ambassadors removed who were not political but career officials. That was done, but without these kinds of interventions. I wondered what that message was being sent. So there was that. And then on the second front, it was very clear at this point that there was, let's just say, a different channel in operation in relations to Ukraine, one that was domestic and political in nature, and that was very different from the channel or the loop, however you like it, that I and my colleagues were in, where we were focused on bilateral relations and U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. And these two things had diverged at this point.
In the run-up to Ambassador Yovanovitch's separation from post, did you have any communications with officials at the State Department about your concerns?
I did.
And who did you relate those concerns to?
I related those concerns directly to my counterpart, who was Acting Assistant Secretary Phil Rieker, who I know you've spoken to. I also spoke to David Hale in the context of, you know, larger meetings about many other issues. I mean, again, I covered a broad portfolio myself, and we often would talk about individual items. And I had private discussions with Deputy Secretary Sullivan. And he, of course, has appeared before committees here in the course of his nomination to be ambassador to Russia and has spoken about that himself.
Okay. And you advocated to all those officials about your concerns about the information being spread about Ambassador Yovanovitch?
I did. That's correct.
The Trump administration changed courses from its predecessor and provided lethal defensive assistance to the Ukraine. Were you in favor of arming the Ukrainians with the javelins?
I was not initially in 2015 before I joined the government, and I'm sure that many people on the committee have seen that I wrote an opinion piece with a colleague at the Brookings Institution in that juncture. Because I was very worried at that particular point in time that the Ukrainian military was not in a fit state to really take on board sophisticated weapons, be they defensive or offensive weapons. And I worried that there was not a long-term sustainable plan given the overwhelming force that the Russians could apply against the Ukrainians. However, when I came into government, in 2017 and started to interact with all of my colleagues in the Pentagon, and you had Laura Cooper here yesterday, I realized, in fact, that there'd been an awful lot of work done on this and that there was a clear and consistent plan for the sustainability long term of the Ukrainian military. So I changed my mind.
Okay. And you're in fact one of the, I believe, the only witness that we've spoken to that has been able to articulate the opposition to providing the javelins. And as we understand it, during the Obama administration, the interagency consensus was, in fact, to provide the javelins, but they were not provided. Were you aware of the decision back then?
I was, and I think it was very much made on a political basis about concerns that this would provoke the Russians, depending on how this was presented. And we were very mindful of that also when there were the discussions internally about the lethal defensive weapons inside of the administration.
And Mr. Holmes, you're on the ground in Kyiv. And the javelins have now been authorized, provided. What's the view from the field, the U.S. Embassy, as to the effectiveness of the javelins?
They're an important strategic deterrent. They're not actively employed in combat operations right now, but the mere idea that were the Russians to advance substantially using certain kinds of armor, that the Ukrainians would have this capability, deters them from doing so. It also thereby sends a very important symbolic message to the Ukrainian military that they have access to this high-end technology and that we trust them to do it. I would only add also that they've offered to buy some using their own funds. The initial tranche was provided through basically a program to do that, but they've now offered to spend their own money to buy more, so I think they think they're important.
And Ambassador Taylor has testified, Mr. Kent has testified that this is, in fact, the consensus of the interagency providing the javelins. Is it the, in your experience of working with Ambassador Taylor, was he also very, very much an advocate for this?
Yes.
Mr. Holmes, I want to go back to name some Americans. Now I want to talk a little bit about Ukrainians, Ukrainian government officials. Are you familiar with Sergei Leshchenko?
Yes.
Have you met with him?
I have.
He was a journalist, then he was in the parliament. Is he currently in the parliament?
Journalist again.
Journalist again. Are you aware that when he was in the parliament, that he had provided information to a Fusion GPS operative named Nelly Orr?
I'm not aware of Nelly Orr. I'm not aware of who he provided information to. I'm aware that as a journalist, he's provided information.
Well, he was in the parliament at the time. This is in the 2016 campaign. He provided widely known as the Black Ledger. Have you ever heard of the Black Ledger?
I have.
And the Black Ledger, is that seen as credible information?
Yes.
The Black Ledger is credible?
Yes.
Bob Mueller did not find it credible. Do you dispute what Bob Mueller's findings were? They didn't use it in the prosecution or in the report?
I'm not aware that Bob Mueller did not find it credible. I think it was evidence in other criminal proceedings. Its credibility was not questioned in those proceedings, but I'm not an expert on that matter.
So the motivation for Leshchenko, as was reported, was to go after a Trump campaign official and undermine Trump's candidacy. Are you aware of that?
If you mean by the release of the Black Ledger, I think Leshchenko's motivation was the same motivation he's always expressed, which is to expose corruption in Ukraine.
Right, but he's admitted motivation was to partly at least undermine the Trump candidacy that he did not support.
He has not said that to me. If he said that to you, I'll take your word for it.
And you're aware that you heard Dr. Hill's testimony, but the Steele dossier that contained initially that initial information that was fed in the FBI, were you aware that the Democrats had paid for that information?
So, sir, I never had any involvement directly.
I'm not accusing involvement. I'm just asking if you, not even if you knew at the time, but You now know today that the Democrats had paid for that information.
So I do want to be clear that all that happened before I arrived in Ukraine, so I don't have any firsthand.
I'm not accusing any involvement of you with the Steele dossier.
Understood. But I do want to be clear about that. And then in addition, I have read about those issues, but I'm not an expert on them.
But you're not disputing that the Democrats and the Clinton campaign were the source of funds that funded the Steele dossier?
I wouldn't be in a position to dispute that, sir.
Do you think it's appropriate for political parties to run operatives in foreign countries to dig up dirt on their opponents?
No.
Dr. Hill, do you think it's appropriate for political parties to pay operatives to dig up dirt on their opponents?
I do not.
Thank you. Mr. Pastor.
Turn to the President Zelensky's inauguration. Ambassador Volker testified that he was very pleased with the size of the delegation, although the Vice President was unable to make the trip. Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, and I understand, Dr. Hill, you were involved with some of the logistics and putting the delegation together. What can you tell us about the Vice President's role in attending or not attending?
Well, I know that you've had the testimony of Jennifer Williams from the Vice President's office, and I defer to her as being much closer to the decision-making about the Vice President's attendance. I will say that I and many others hoped that the Vice President would be able to attend. Mm-hmm. And what I know from my perspective, mm-hmm. because I was not involved intimately in discussions with the Vice President or his immediate staff, was that there were some questions about the schedule.
Right.
As you all know, the President and Vice President can not be out of the country at the same time. And there were some questions about presidential travel in the same time frame. There was quite a bit of back and forth as to whether it would be really feasible for the Vice President in that time frame to go. So that was what I was aware of. I wasn't aware to the extent of the discussions that obviously Ms. Williams was involved in.
Right. The President was traveling in Japan, and then he was headed to Europe for the D-Day anniversary. The Vice President's office, according to Ms. Williams, provided 4 days, the end of May, the 29th, 30th, 31st. June 1st, and as it turned out, the Ukrainians decided, I believe it was on May 16th, to schedule the inauguration for 4 days later. And by this point in time, the Vice President had been rerouted for a trip to Canada about the USMCA, and I just want to ask you whether you don't have any evidence that the Vice President was encouraged not to attend for any other reason, do you?
I personally do not, but again, I defer to Ms. Williams.
And Ms. Williams' testimony was that she heard from the Chief of Staff's assistant that the Vice President was not able to go. The reason for that was related to any of these investigations hasn't been fully established. I want to just note from the materials you provided for your deposition, there was a discussion whether President Orban may have influenced President Trump's decision on that May 13th day. And did you remember when the meeting was with President Orban?
I do.
When was that?
That was in May. That's correct.
So do you remember what time of day it was on the 13th?
To be honest, usually these meetings are around lunchtime, sometime in that time frame, in the kind of early to mid part of the day.
Right.
But I can't speak for sure, and I just want to be very clear that I cannot speak about head of state engagements.
Okay. Jennifer Williams testified that she learned about 11 or 11:15, and the meeting with President Orban was not scheduled until later in the afternoon. According to your schedule, it was right around 1:45. Is that consistent with your recollection?
Well, about the lunchtime time frame, yeah.
Okay.
Depending on when one has lunch, I guess.
Okay. But overall, given the 4 days' notice, given Secretary Perry's involvement, do you think the delegation was a good-sized group?
I do, and let me also make a point that we don't try to make these delegations large. This is on the taxpayer's dime. And it's pretty expensive getting people there if you have to get military air. And, you know, we try to keep them small. If we had a longer lead time, you know, perhaps we would have made other arrangements. But, you know, 4 days is not a lot of time to make an arrangement.
And Secretary Perry had become interested in some of the energy-related issues in the Ukraine.
I actually recommended that Secretary Perry be the lead, along with others.
And what can you tell us about his involvement in some of the Ukrainian policy?
Well, Secretary Perry's engagement in this made, again, perfect sense, given his role as Secretary of Energy, also his deep knowledge of the energy industry, his former governorship. Secretary Perry himself is an extraordinarily good advocate of U.S. interests, particularly in the energy sphere. And one of Ukraine's Achilles' heel, in addition to its military disadvantage with Russia, is in fact energy. Ukraine remains for now the main transit point for Russian oil and gas and pipelines to Europe. And this has been manipulated repeatedly, especially since 2006, by the Russian government. And in fact, I mean, many of you here will remember, in the Reagan era, there was a huge dispute between the United States and Europe about the about whether it made sense for Europe to build pipelines from the then Soviet Union to bring gas to European markets.
Mr. Holmes, what was your view of the delegation? Do you think it was the right size group, right level of prestige to signal to the incoming Zelensky administration that the U.S. stands behind them?
I think it was fine in that regard.
Okay. You can.
Since we're on the topic of Ukraine energy, I think it's a good way for us to segue into Burisma, which I assume both of you are familiar with. You've heard about it for many, many years. You're on the ground there now, Mr. Holmes. I know you weren't there but at the time, but in September 2015, then Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, Obama appointed career ambassador. I'm sure you know him.
I do.
Credible?
Yes.
Successful ambassador, I'm sure. He called for an investigation into Zelensky, the owner of Burisma, President Burisma. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. Did you know about Deputy Assistant Secretary of State's Kent's concerns about the potential conflict of interest with Hunter Biden sitting on the board of Burisma?
I would defer to George Kent, who was involved at the time and is an expert on those issues.
As you know, that the financial records show that this Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to the American accounts of Hunter Biden.
I've heard that.
Were you familiar with that, Dr. Hill?
Only from newspaper reports.
Okay. Did you know that Burisma's American, and this is back to you, sure, Mr. Holmes, did you know that Burisma's American legal representatives met with Ukrainian officials just days after the vice president forced the firing of the country's chief prosecutor?
No.
Did you know that Burisma's American lawyers tried to secure a meeting with the new state prosecutor the same day the predecessor, Viktor Shokin's firing was announced?
No.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Porochenko at least three times in February 2016, shortly after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
No.
Did you know that Devin Archer and Hunter Biden reached out to the Deputy Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, shortly after the raid on Burisma?
No.
So, Dr. Hill, did you know about, I don't want to go through and ask all those questions over
again. I also did not know.
You did not know about any of those?
I did not know, no.
Okay. So, you obviously know that the president had concerns about Burisma, had concerns about 2016 election meddling by the Ukrainians. When you were in there as the head of the Ukraine desk, did you ever raise any of these? Did you ever brief the president or raise it up to Ambassador Bolton about any concerns through 2017 and 18 that concerned 2016 election meddling or
Burisma concerns?
The whole briefing process didn't really work in the way that you're suggesting there. So if the president had asked about any of this information, it would have been provided for him. Just to be very clear, Ukraine was not a top foreign policy priority in this period, in the same way that many other issues that we could talk about, from Syria to Turkey and others, are. So there weren't that frequent briefings on Ukraine. The briefings would take place when there was a scheduled meeting with a Ukrainian head of state. Mm-hmm. And as we know, there haven't been too many of those.
So just to, but as far as you know, you did no briefings, no papers, answered no questions as it relates to the 2016 election or Burisma during your time there?
No, I did not, no.
And Dr. Hill, you told us during your deposition that indeed that there are perceived conflict of interest troubles when the child of a government official is involved with something that government official has an official policy role in, correct?
I think any family member of any member of the U.S. government, Congress, or the Senate is open to all kinds of questions about optics and of perhaps undue outside influence if they take part in any kind of activity that could be misconstrued as being related to their parent or other family member's work. So as a matter of course, yes, I do think that's the case.
Getting back to Ambassador Sondland, you testified that every now and then he made a habit of name-dropping his interactions with the president.
That's correct, yes.
And I believe you also told us that there were instances where you would run into him on the campus and he would say, oh, I'm here to see the president, or I've been in to see the president, and you had an occasion to circle back and found out that wasn't the case?
That's correct.
And I just want to give you an opportunity. He testified about some sort of coffee he had with you on your last day, and I think when the deposition transcript was released, your counsel indicated that was completely fabricated on Ambassador Sondland's part, and I just want to give you an opportunity to address that.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, this is the federal government. We don't have coffee machines, you know, readily in our office. If you'd come to my office in that time, the best I could have offered you was a cup of water from the water fountain outside of my office. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the coffee that Ambassador Sondland and I shared was actually, we ran into each other, or rather he found out I was going to be there and then asked me to meet him for coffee in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in 2018 in August. So this is a full year before I left. That was a very nice coffee, so perhaps he, you know, conflated those two meetings together. The meeting that he was referring to, he had come in to meet with our director for the European Union. This was in my last week in the office. And as I was in the office at the same time for a brief period before going into another meeting, and it was my last week in the office, we agreed to sit down with the director of the European Union, with actually Colonel Vindman, and the assistant that Ambassador Sondland had brought with him from the State Department. So there were actually four of us in that meeting, and unfortunately it wasn't over coffee.
And, you know, he went on to indicate that you were upset, and you were upset with
actually,
Ambassador...
There were five of us really in the meeting. Obviously, I can't do math, sorry.
Fair enough. He indicated you were upset, and you were upset with Ambassador Bolton, and upset with the way things are going, and I believe your counsel said that was an outright fabrication.
Well, I think you might recall in my deposition on October 14th that I said that very unfortunately I had a bit of a blow-up with Ambassador Sondland, and I had a couple of testy encounters with him. One of those was in June 18, when I actually said to him, who put you in charge of Ukraine? And, you know, I'll admit I was a bit rude, and that's when he told me the president, which shut me up. And this other meeting, it was about 15, 20 minutes, exactly as he depicted it was. I was actually, to be honest, angry with him. And, I hate to say it, but often when women show anger, it's not fully appreciated. It's often, you know, pushed onto emotional issues, perhaps, or deflected onto other people. And what I was angry about was that he wasn't coordinating with us. Now, I actually realized, having listened to his deposition, that he was absolutely right. That he wasn't coordinating with us because we weren't doing the same thing that he was doing. So I was upset with him that he wasn't fully telling us about all of the meetings that he was having. And he said to me, but I'm briefing the president. I'm briefing Chief of Staff Mulvaney. I'm briefing Secretary Pompeo, and I've talked to Ambassador Bolton. Who else do I have to deal with? And the point is we have a robust interagency process that deals with Ukraine. It includes Mr. Holmes. It includes Ambassador Taylor as the chargé in Ukraine. It includes a whole load of other people. But it struck me one yesterday when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said these are the people who need to know that he was absolutely right, because he was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged. So he was correct, and I had not put my finger on that at the moment, but I was irritated with him and angry with him that he wasn't fully coordinating. And I did say to him, Ambassador Sondland, Gordon, I think this is all going to blow up, and here we are. And after I left to my next meeting, our director for the European Union talked to him much further for a full half hour or more later, trying to ask him about how we could coordinate better or how others could coordinate better after I had left the office. And his feeling was that the National Security Council was always trying to block him. What we were trying to do was block us from straying into domestic or personal politics. And that was precisely what I was trying to do. But Ambassador Sondland is not wrong that he had been given a different remit than we had been. And it was at that moment that I started to realize how those things had diverged. And I realized, in fact, that I wasn't really being fair to Ambassador Sondland, because he was carrying out what he thought he had been instructed to carry out. And we were doing something that we thought was just as, or perhaps even more important, but it wasn't in the same channel.
Dr. Hill, if you mind, answer, sorry. Dr. Hill, I just want to drill down on this a little bit. The President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief, was concerned about the 2016 elections and Burisma. He had his personal attorney working these issues because he was under investigation by Robert Mueller, special counsel, partly beginning with an investigation that started with the Steele dossier that we've already established that the Democrats had paid for and had then fed into the FBI. So at the end of the day, the commander-in-chief concerned about 2016 election meddling by Ukraine sounds like you had just earlier testified that you weren't aware of that. But if that was the concern of the president to try to get to the bottom of it, and it's the concern of Ambassador Sondland, who was trying to set up meetings on behalf of to ensure that meetings occurred and phone calls occurred to strengthen the relationship, I understand the people at the NSC, people at the State Department had issues with that, but at the end of the day, isn't it the commander-in-chief that makes those decisions?
My point, Mr. Nunes, is that we at the National Security Council were not told, either by the President directly or through Ambassador Bolton, that we were to be focused on these issues as a matter of U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. So when you're talking about Ukraine in 2016, I never personally heard the President say anything specific about 2016 in Ukraine. I've seen him saying plenty of things publicly, but I was not given a directive. In fact, I was given a directive on July 10th by Ambassador Bolton very clearly to stay out of domestic politics.
And just for sake of the timeline, I think as of July 19th, they hadn't even engaged with Rudy Giuliani yet. I don't believe that happened until a little bit later. So you believe by July 19th they were already engaged in those types of activities?
We had already had a discussion with Kurt Volker, which was in the depositions of his assistant, Chris Anderson, that indicated that he had met with Rudy Giuliani at this point. And Ambassador Sondland made comments about meeting with Giuliani. And as we know, in the May 23rd meeting, they had been instructed to meet with Giuliani.
Right.
They gave us every impression that they were meeting with Rudy Giuliani at this point, and Rudy Giuliani was also saying on the television, and indeed has said subsequently, that he was closely coordinating with the State Department.
Okay,
so it was my belief that they were meeting with him.
Okay. And there's some ambiguity in the direction to work with Rudy Giuliani. Ambassador Volker said the president dismissed Ukraine and said, oh, if you want to work on it, just go talk to Rudy. And Ambassador Sondland took that a little bit differently. And I believe that Ambassador Volker was primarily the interlocutor with Mr. Giuliani, and that was happening didn't start until the end of July.
I only learned that subsequently from Ambassador Volker's deposition. So I just want to tell you, in that particular time frame, I was not aware of that. And in fact, Gordon Sondland did refer to Rudy Giuliani. And again, Ambassador Bolton had warned Ambassador Volker not to meet with Rudy Giuliani in a meeting.
Mr. Morrison told us both in his deposition and his public hearing that you had related concerns about Colonel Vindman's judgment.
I did not relate any concerns in general terms about Colonel Vindman's judgment, so I was somewhat surprised when I heard Mr. Morrison make that assertion and when I read his deposition. There was a very specific point that was made, and again, these are personnel issues, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that nobody here would like to have their private personnel issues put before a committee, but you've asked me about this. So I had a couple of very short transition meetings with Mr. Morrison. And again, Mr. Morrison did not work in our directorate. He was taking over the position, which he held for 3 months. I had worked as the director, the senior director for Europe and Eurasia, it was at the time, for more than 2 years at this point, and I'd been working for a year with Colonel Vindman, with Mr. Vindman. And in the course of one of the meetings, sometime in the June timeframe, I sat down with Mr. Morrison and with a deputy, referred to him in his deposition, John Erith, who was also working, and we went through our organizational chart. We went through who was staying, who was rotating out and leaving in the summer, and we talked about everybody's strengths and weaknesses. And I always ask my staff to do upward feedback as well, to talk about what I wasn't doing right either. I'd like to learn too. Yes. And I said that I was concerned about the way things were trending in Ukraine policy. So Colonel Vindman is a highly distinguished, decorated military officer. He came over to us from the chairman's office and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And we were evaluating and looking at him in the context of what his future positions would be in the context of the U.S. Army. And I was concerned that if, for example, Colonel Vindman might decide to leave the military, that perhaps he wasn't as well suited for something that would be much more political. I did not feel that he had the political antenna to deal with something that was straying into domestic politics. Not everyone is suited for that. That does not mean in any way that I was questioning his overall judgment, nor was I questioning in any way his substantive expertise. He is excellent on issues related to Ukraine, Belarus and Moldova, on Russian defense issues. He had been in charge of the Russia campaign, thinking through at the chairman's office and in the Pentagon. This was a very specific issue, because by June, we saw that things were diverging and you needed a completely different sensitivity. Some people in my office have worked at the highest levels of advisory positions, and Mr. Morrison had come from Capitol Hill. He knew politics inside out, and we said that Colonel Vindman did not, and we were concerned about how he would manage what was becoming a highly charged and potentially partisan issue, which had not been before.
And Colonel Vindman related to us during his deposition that he subsequently was sort of cut out of a lot of the decision-making and involvements with the embassy in Ukraine. Was that something you recommended?
Not with the embassy in Ukraine. I mean, we did pull him back from the meeting in May in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, we were very concerned about these political aspects to this. And we did not feel, when July 10th, Colonel Vindman was justified to be alarmed when he realized that there was this highly political aspect of the meeting that we were looking for eventually with President Zelensky.
And Mr. Holmes, I want to, at the end of August, we understand that Ambassador Taylor was engaged in obtaining some information for the President about European allies' burden sharing in the region as the decision about aid was being debated.
So, sir, after the hold was placed on the security assistance, and many people, I think, were scrambling to try to understand why. I believe it was Senator Johnson who had said the president was concerned about burden sharing, perhaps others as well. And so trying to interpret why this might have happened, we were looking into the facts of what the Europeans have provided and what we have provided. Very illuminating what we learned. United States has provided combined civilian and military assistance to Ukraine since 2014 of about $3 billion plus two $1 billion
three $1 billion loan guarantees. That's not, those get paid back largely. So just over $3 billion. The Europeans, at the level of the European Union plus the member states combined since 2014, my understanding, have provided a combined $12 billion to Ukraine.
And you were able to communicate that information back at the end of August?
I believe so. Yeah, we were. This is done in collaboration with other missions, the EU, mm-hmm. to NATO, and others. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you think that was the information the White House was looking for?
We don't know. If the concern was that we weren't, that others weren't spending as much as we were to support Ukraine, then that information showed a different story.
Okay. And the aid was subsequently lifted. The pause in the aid was lifted shortly thereafter.
It was in early September, in mid-September.
Go back.
That concludes the 45-minute rounds. We'll now go to member questioning. I'll recognize myself for 5 minutes. First, as a threshold matter, I want to say to the witnesses to be a bit cautious when members represent. Are you aware of this fact? Are you aware of that fact? Do you know that so-and-so testified to this or testified to that? If you have personal knowledge of it, that's fine. I'm not saying this is deliberate. Sometimes members get it wrong. So let me just clear the record on one of the things that was suggested to you, that the vice president canceled his trip because of a conflict with the trip to Canada. That was not Ms. Williams' testimony. Her testimony was, I asked my colleague why we should stop trip planning and why the vice president would not be attending, and I was informed that the president had decided the vice president would not attend the inauguration. So just offer that caution. Dr. Hill, I want to ask you, you may be aware of some of the attacks on Colonel Vindman, suggesting that he has a dual loyalty, that he's not really loyal to America, he's loyal to Ukraine. I want to ask you, as a fellow immigrant, what you think of those kind of accusations when they're leveled against Colonel Vindman or other Americans.
I think it's very unfortunate. I mean, this is a country of immigrants. With the exception, perhaps of very few people still here, everyone immigrated to the United States at some point in their family history. And this is what, for me, really does make America great. I mean, I'm sure that every single person here, some people perhaps came reluctantly, others came by choice, as I did. But this is, for me, this is the essence of America. It's why I wanted to be here and why I wanted to stay here. And I think it's unfair to castigate anyone. Everyone has some kind of appellate to them. I'm an Anglo-American, perhaps, then, or I'm a British-American, I'm a naturalized citizen. I do not believe that my loyalty is to the United Kingdom. My loyalty is here to the United States. This is my country and the country that I serve. And I know for a fact that every single one of my colleagues, and there were many naturalized citizens in my office and across the National Security Council, felt exactly the same way. I think it's deeply unfair.
I thank you. You mentioned something in your testimony, I might not have this exactly right, that I think Ambassador Sondland at one point told you his role was to make deals, is that right?
That's correct.
I
and he told
you
other people that as well, to be clear.
I want to ask you about one of those deals, the one that Ambassador Bolton described as a drug deal. I have the suggestion, or the indication rather, when Mr. Goldman was asking questions about the July 10th meeting and the fact there were two meetings, one Ambassador Bolton's presence and then another in the wardroom, that there was more you had to say about that. Do you want to walk us through that in a little more detail?
Well, the reference that Ambassador Bolton made was after I returned from the wardroom and related to him what I had heard. There was sequencing of meetings, which I know that there's been some concern about the sequencing here and discrepancies between various depositions. So what happened immediately after the meeting that Ambassador Bolton caught a little short was that he told me to hold back in the room. And he was escorting out the Ukrainian visitors, along with Secretary Perry and Ambassadors Volker and Sondland. And I guess they wanted to take a quick photograph outside of his office. And I know that Secretary Perry and others have tweeted out that photograph, beautiful sunny day, and there's a picture of all of them standing just outside of Ambassador Bolton's office. This is very quick. He came back in. And at that point, I guess they were already moving down to the wardroom, because on the way out of Ambassador Bolton's office, Ambassador Sondland had said, let's regroup in the wardroom for a quick cuddle on next steps, which, to be honest, was quite unusual. You don't usually huddle in a room in the White House to discuss next steps with foreign delegations, because we took it to be next steps on setting up the meeting, which already, as I'd said, Ambassador Bolton wasn't prepared to do. And when Ambassador Bolton came back into the office, that's when he gave me the very strong instruction to go downstairs, find out what was being discussed, and to come right back up and report it to him. And as I came into the wardroom, Alex Vindman, Colonel Vindman, and Ambassador Sondland were in an exchange, and that's when I noticed that Colonel Vindman looked quite alarmed. Now, I know that Ambassador Sondland was asked yesterday, because, again, I watched all of his testimony, and I watched it very carefully, that there were some questions about yelling and shouting. I certainly never said that, and there was no yelling and shouting. That's some embellishment that's crept in, perhaps in media depictions, or how people like to retell these stories and add things to them. When I came in, Ambassador Sondland was in an exchange with Colonel Vindman, along the lines of, well, we have an agreement to have this meeting. And I came in and I asked what's going on here, and he said, and this is again, the Ukrainians are there, Ambassador Volker was there, but at this point, I also want to stress, Secretary Perry had left. He was not in the wardroom when I came. As I was coming in, Secretary Perry and his colleagues were leaving, so Secretary Perry has no recollection of this meeting because he was not in it. And so when I came in, Gordon Sondland was basically saying, well, look, we have a deal here that there will be a meeting. I have a deal here with Chief of Staff Mulvaney. There will be a meeting if the Ukrainians open up or announce these investigations and into 2016 in Burisma. And I cut it off immediately there. Because by this point, having heard Mr. Giuliani over and over again on the television and all of the issues that he was asserting, by this point it was clear that Burisma was code for the Bidens, because Giuliani was laying it out there. I could see why Colonel Vindman was alarmed. And he said, this is inappropriate. We're the National Security Council. We can't be involved in this. And I've learned, you know, since from Mr. Holmes's rendition here today, that Colonel Vindman has already warned the Ukrainians, or in fact President Zelensky, no less, to stay out of American politics, domestic politics. So I cut off this line and I said to Ambassador Sondland, look, we need procedures for here. Ambassador Bolton just made it clear we can't set up the meeting right now. We have to properly prepare this through the proper process. I know this sounds all very boring, but, you know, we have national security procedures to do this. And I said, we really shouldn't be litigating this or talking about this in front of our colleagues from Ukraine. And it's completely inappropriate for us to be thrashing this out in front of them. And he agreed, and we asked our Ukrainian colleagues to move into the corridor outside the wardroom. And I explained where this is in their deposition, which is also extraordinarily awkward, because they shouldn't have been standing around in a corridor in the, you know, basically in the West Wing at this particular juncture. And that's when I pushed back on Ambassador Sondland and said, look, I know there's differences about whether when we should have this meeting. We're trying to figure out whether we should have it after the Ukrainian parliamentary elections, the Rada elections, which by that point I think had been set for July 21st. It must have been, because this is July 10th at this point. And Ambassador Bolton would like to wait until after that to basically see whether President Zelensky gets a majority in the parliament, which would enable him to form a cabinet, and then we can move forward. And Ambassador Sondland then said, okay, fair enough. He realized he wasn't going to, you know, be able to push this further. Ambassador Volker didn't say anything at this particular juncture. And then he said he had another meeting, and they all left. And I went back up and relayed this to Ambassador Bolton, which is when he gave me the very specific instruction that we've already been through, to go to talk to Mr. Eisenberg, John Eisenberg, in the Ernest C. Council's office.
Thank you. Mr. Nunes.
I assume we're getting 8 minutes there.
Mr. Nunes, I don't cut off a witness in the middle of their answer. You may proceed.
Sorry, that was a long answer.
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Holmes, why didn't your boss talk about it?
What's that, sir?
Why didn't your boss bring up the call that you overheard, the reason you're here today? I mean, you're their closing witness, yet their star witness, their first witness, Ambassador Taylor, didn't even bring it up. And when we deposed you, you said this was an extremely distinctive experience, one of the most remarkable events of my life. You described it like this. You said, after the call happens, I immediately told Deputy Chief of Mission and others at the embassy about the call. Then you said you went on vacation. You told several friends and family about the call. Then you come back on August 6th, and you tell Ambassador Taylor about the call. And then in your deposition statement, you said in your statement today as well, I repeatedly referred to the call in meetings and conversations where the issue of the president's interest in Ukraine was relevant. I repeatedly referred to the call in meetings and conversations where the issue of the president's interest in Ukraine was relevant. That sounds like government speak for you told everybody. Yet their star witness, their first witness, Ambassador Taylor, when he came here, he related 13 different conversations he had between July 18th when the aid is frozen, September 11th when it's released. 13 different conversations, never once mentioning this call. July 19th, Dr. Hill and Colonel Vindman told Taylor what Sondland told them. July 19th, Sondland told Taylor about the upcoming Trump-Zelensky call. July 20th, Sondland told Taylor what Sondland told Zelensky to tell Trump. July 20th, Daniluk tells Taylor what Zelensky told Daniluk. July 28th, Morrison tells Taylor what happened on the Trump-Zelensky call. August 16th, Volker tells Taylor what Yarmak told Volker. August 21st, Breckbull talks to Taylor. August 22nd, Morrison talks to Taylor. August 29th, Yarmak talks to Taylor. September 1st, Morrison tells Taylor what Sondland told Morrison about what Yarmak told Sondland. September 2nd, Morrison tells Taylor what Daniluk told Morrison. September 7th, Morrison tells Taylor what Sondland told Trump. And September 8th, Sondland tells Taylor what Trump told Sondland. Nowhere. Nowhere is there a Holmes tells Taylor what the President of the United States told Sondland.
May I answer that question?
13 conversations. Yeah, I'll give you a chance here in a second. But 13 conversations from their star witness. You're their closing witness. And he can't remember a call from a guy he works with every single day. Why?
Yes, sir. So immediately when I went back to the embassy after this lunch on the 26th, I told my direct supervisor, the deputy chief of mission, I would have told Ambassador Taylor immediately, except he was on the front lines that afternoon. I then went on, as I testified, my vacation on Saturday, came back the following Monday, and on Tuesday I was back in the ambassador's office where I referred to the call in that week plus that I was away. It was my assumption that the deputy chief of mission would have informed other people about the call as well. So my recollection is when I did refer to the call in that meeting that Ambassador Taylor nodded knowingly as though he had been briefed on it. So I referred to the call and I mentioned some of my takeaways from the call. And at the time, the main takeaway from the call was the president doesn't care about Ukraine. So we're going to have a tough road ahead to convince him that it's important enough for him to schedule an Oval Office meeting for President Zelensky and ultimately to release this hold on security assistance. That was the takeaway. And that's what I referred to repeatedly in the coming weeks whenever it became relevant. And I'll remind you, sir, that one more important point. Throughout this time, as I testified, we were trying to find a formula, things we could do with Ukrainians that would convince the president that they were worth talking to.
Maybe Mr. Holmes, the takeaway was he thought it was no big deal because he already knew. He didn't remember because we already had the transcript. We had the Trump-Zelensky transcript had been out for 2 months.
Sir, I believe that
Even though you're repeatedly bringing this conversation up, as you said, to everybody anytime there's a talk about Ukraine, you recall this conversation. Maybe it was the transcript. The call happened on the July 25th. That's 4 months ago. The transcript's been out for 2 months. Maybe the ambassador thought this is nothing new here. But Shazam, last week you come forward with supposedly this new information. There is nothing different in there than what we had on the transcript. Maybe that's the reason their star witness, their first witness, didn't bring it up. But they had to have something. So you're their closing witness because you overheard the president talking to Ambassador Sondland.
Sir, if I could answer, I see 4 seconds left on the clock.
Mr. Holmes, you may take as long as you need.
Thank you, sir. I believe that Ambassador Taylor did already know when I briefed him when I returned from vacation on the 6th. It was not news to him that the president was pressing for a Biden investigation.
That's not what I asked. I asked why he didn't share with us.
Mr. Jordan, please do not interrupt the witness any further. Mr. Holmes,
this is exactly
Mr. Jordan's time has expired, but yours is not.
Okay, thank you.
You may answer the question.
It's exactly my point. I briefed the call in detail of the deputy chief of mission, went away for a week, come back, I refer to the call, and everyone is nodding. Of course that's what's going on. Of course the president is pressing
for a Biden investigation before he'll do these things the Ukrainians want. There was nodding agreement. So did I go through every single word in the call? No, because everyone by that point agreed. It was obvious what the president was pressing for. And Ambassador Taylor, as you've just outlined, had all those other interactions with
all these
other
people. But he didn't share it with us.
Mr. Jordan, please do not interrupt.
But, sir, then... But, sir, my vivid recollection of an event I was involved with was a touchstone experience that, to me, validated
and
what,
sir, Jordan, could, please,
what we
interrupt.
Believed. And Ambassador Taylor was not in that call.
And so all of a sudden last week, you've got to come tell
Mr. Jordan,
us, right?
Mr. Jordan,
you know your boss will
allow the witness to answer the question.
I'll finish with this.
Thank you.
He was involved in a number of other interactions, as you've outlined, that brought him to the same conclusion. It is quite possible that
but he doesn't share the one that
Mr.
The guy
Jordan,
he worked
Mr. Jordan,
with.
Mr. Jordan, share
Mr.
That Jordan, one. You may not like the witness's answer, but we
no,
will hear it.
There wasn't an answer.
Mr. Jordan, we will hear the witness's answer. Have you concluded, Mr. Holmes?
I have, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Himes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Hill, Mr. Holmes. Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Hill, you made a fairly dramatic comment in your opening statement to which the ranking member took some exception. I'm more interested in the Ukraine piece of this, but you said some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country and that perhaps somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. I'm really much more interested in the Ukraine piece of this, but I do want to defend you briefly. I don't know what my colleagues believe, but I do have a pretty good sense of what the effects are of creating ambiguity, of lacking clarity and conviction around the Russian attack on the election of 2016. In response to your comment, the ranking member offered up a report which varies in material respects from the report that was created by the 17 agencies of the intelligence community. A day does not go by in which ranking member Nunes does not speak of the Russia hoax. And this is an area in which context is pretty important. Dr. Hill, let me read you a comment by another senior official. Why did Democratic National Committee turn down the DHS offer to protect against hacks? It's all a big Dem hoax, all caps. Why did the DNC refuse to turn over its server to the FBI? It's all a big Dem scam. Dr. Hill, do you know who said those things?
I don't.
That's the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. So you might be forgiven for your...
Yeah,
you didn't miss much. But my point is, and tell me if you agree or disagree, ambiguity, a failure to name and shame the Russians for the attack in 2016, that is not in the service of our national security, is it?
It's not, no.
It's not. So let's turn to Ukraine. Dr. Hill, have you seen you characterize the idea that Ukraine interfered in the election as a fictional narrative. Have you seen any evidence at all that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
Well, I brought with me two exhibits that I was pointed to, in fact, by our colleagues during the deposition that I gave on October 14th. And actually, I'm quite grateful that they pointed me in this direction. I was presented during my deposition with two articles, or at least two pieces of information. One was an op-ed that the Ukrainian ambassador Charlie wrote in 2016 in The Hill. So this is during the presidential campaign when President Trump was then the nominee for the Republican Party. And this is Ambassador Charlie, who was then, you know, still the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, being critical of President Trump, who was then the nominee for the Republican Party, for making comments about Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia.
May I interrupt you there? Let me be very specific about what those comments were. The president, when he was a candidate, said, quote, "The people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be with Russia than where they were." So Ambassador Charlie is responding to that in that article, correct?
That's correct. And he just uses this as a peg because, to be honest, the whole article is actually about Ukraine. And this is classic standard for anyone who wants to write an op-ed. I've written plenty of them myself. You pick a peg by something that you or somebody else might have said, and then you proceed to say what you want to say.
Right. So here
this
it is.
What Ambassador Charlie does is he talks facts about Ukraine's position vis-a-vis Russia and Russian aggression against Ukraine.
Yeah, and let me just read, because it's worth people hearing what this severe attack on candidate Trump, who has suggested that the Crimeans would rather be with Russia. Ambassador Charlie writes, "Even if Trump's comments are only speculative and do not really reflect a future foreign policy, they call for appeasement of an aggressor and support the violation of a sovereign country's territorial integrity and another's breach of international law." Dun, dun, dun. That's the attack on candidate Trump.
That's
Does that
correct.
Sound like election interference to you?
Well, I would say that it's probably not the most advisable thing to do for an ambassador, because you never know who's going to win. And I think that the second piece that was presented to me at great length, and I want to thank Mr. Castor for making me go back and read it again, because when you asked me the questions about it, I did remember the piece. Kenneth Vogel is a very well-known and, you know, as you've pointed out, extremely good journalist. And I'd remembered reading this back in the day in January of 2017, but it had been a long time between then and October. And you gave me a copy, and I went back and read it again, because I think it actually is extraordinarily important. It gets to this issue here. Mr. Vogel points out that the Ukrainian government, again, you know, they wouldn't have done very well at the bookies, picking up the issue I pointed out at the beginning of today, they bet on the wrong horse. They bet on Hillary Clinton winning the election. And so, you know, they were trying to curry favor with the Clinton campaign. It's quite evident in here. And he relates, you know, to some extent, individuals and some Ukrainian officials, like Mr. Avakov, the interior minister, and a number of other people that he names here and that have been named at various points, and talks about how they were trying to collect information, as Ranking Member Nunes said, on Mr. Manafort and on and other people as well. However, I do want to point out that the crux of the article here by Mr. Vogel is he said there was little evidence of a top-down effort by Ukraine. And he makes a distinction between the Russian effort that was personally directed by Russian President Putin and involved the country's military and foreign intelligence services. Now, I don't think that those two things are exactly the same. I also mentioned in my deposition of October 14th, that in fact many officials from many countries, including Ukraine, bet on the wrong horse. They believed that Secretary Clinton, former Senator Clinton, former First Lady Clinton was going to win. And many said some pretty disparaging and hurtful things about President Trump, and I can't blame him for feeling aggrieved about them. And when we were setting up head of state visits, and I remember I have a portfolio of 50-plus countries plus NATO and the European Union, we thought it prudent to collect as much as possible about comments that people might have said about the president during the campaign, when he was either one of the candidates to be the nominee for the Republican Party, or when he was actually the candidate running against Hillary Clinton. And I'm sorry to say that an awful lot, and perhaps I shouldn't name them here because it will have consequences, an awful lot of senior officials in many governments, including our allied governments, said some pretty hurtful things about the president. And I would also personally take offense at some of the things that were said if I were the president. Now, the difference here, however, is that that hasn't had any major impact on his feelings towards those countries. Not that I have seen. But I've also heard the president say, and he said it in public, so I'm not revealing any kind of executive privilege here, that Ukraine tried to take me down. What I have seen is that there's some ill-advised Ukrainian officials. Ambassador Charlie's been removed as being the ambassador from here, made some pretty, you know, unpleasant statements about, or some ill-advised op-eds. But I could list a whole host of ambassadors from allied countries who tweeted out, who had public comments about the president as well, and it did not affect security assistance having meetings with them. If it would, there'd been a lot of people he wouldn't have met with.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. Mr. Chairman, I seek unanimous consent to add to the record a Politico article of December 1st, 2016, entitled "Russia Accuses Ukraine of Sabotaging Trump." It outlines Russian senior officials making allegations that there was Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election.
Without objection. Mr. Conaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield to Ms. Ratcliffe, 5 minutes.
Thank the gentleman for yielding. I want to pick up where my colleague across the aisle, Congressman Himes, left off earlier. Respectfully, Dr. Hill, he was not defending you. He was defending himself and Democrats. I want to make sure the record is very clear. Ranking Member Nunes was correct. He correctly noted in his opening that Republicans, not Democrats on this committee, were the first ones to raise the issue of Russian interference in the 2016 election. The disagreement wasn't about Russian meddling. The disagreement was about whether or not President Trump conspired with Russia, a false allegation peddled by the Democrats generally and specifically by some Democrats on this committee. With that, Mr. Holmes, I want to turn to you and the part of the conversation, your testimony where you said you heard President Trump say, is he going to do the investigation? And Ambassador Sondland said he's going to do it. He'll do anything you ask him to. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
What did President Trump say next?
He said, good, what about Sweden?
He said what?
Sir, I need to look at back where we are in the middle of the conversation here. Where are we from the testimony? Exactly. So then they turned to the Sweden conversation.
What did President Trump say next?
He said, good, what about Sweden?
Good, what about Sweden? Good, what about Sweden? Why isn't that in your statement?
Sir, it's not a word for word, every single word in the conversation.
But it's the most important part of the conversation.
Well, then they turned to Sweden. They turned to the other topic.
Respectfully, Mr. Holmes, this impeachment inquiry is based on the call the day before where President Trump, as part of a bribery scheme, as part of an extortion scheme, as part of a quid pro quo, according to the Democrats, demanded investigations in exchange for either military aid or a White House meeting. And the next day, you were witness to President Trump receiving word that the bribery scheme was successful, the extortion scheme was successful. And his response was, good. What about Sweden?
Yes, sir. The Ukraine portion of that conversation was extremely brief.
What was the first thing the president said on the call? You had a clear recollection of this conversation.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Ratka, please allow Mr. Holmes to answer.
Yes, sir. Sondland greeted the president.
How?
He said, hello, Mr. President, I'm in Kyiv. And the president said, are you in Ukraine?
You think he said, I think you're in Ukraine? He said what?
He said, are you in Kyiv, Ukraine?
What did you hear President Trump say about ASAP Rocky?
I did not hear President Trump's side of the conversation about ASAP Rocky.
You said, how did we go from the conversation was very loud and his voice was recognizable to, as you say here, when the conversation shifted, I could only hear Ambassador Sondland's side of the conversation.
Yes, sir. As I've testified, the initial part of the call, Ambassador Sondland, sort of when the president came on the call, he sort of winced and held the phone away from his ear for the initial portion of the call. And then at some point in the call, he stopped doing that. And I don't know why. I don't know if he turned the volume down. I don't know if the president spoke less, more quietly. I don't know if he got used to the volume. I don't know what changed.
What did change? It's important. This was memorable.
I don't know, sir. It was Ambassador Sondland stopped moving the phone away from his ear. That's what it was? Yes.
Okay. How did the conversation end?
I only heard Ambassador Sondland's side of the conversation, sir. And at the end of the conversation, he was giving the president advice on how to deal with this ASAP Rocky situation. And he said, they should have released him on your word, and you can tell the Kardashians you tried.
Okay. So to be clear, when President Trump received word that President Zelensky had agreed to the investigations, he said, good. What about Sweden?
Yes.
Okay. When exactly did Gordon Sondland asked President Zelensky about the investigations?
I'm sorry, sir?
When did he ask about the investigations?
When did Gordon Sondland ask Zelensky about the investigations?
Yeah.
You're asking in which meeting did he raise the investigations?
Well, it was raised the day before on a call, and the next day, Gordon Sondland said the answer to that was he's going to do the investigation. So when did he ask about the investigation?
My assumption is he did it in the closed-door meeting with Yermak.
Well, I don't want to...
time of the gentleman has expired.
I appreciate that, but I want to make sure the record's clear that yesterday Ambassador Sondland testified that the topic of conversations did not come up on that day.
Time of the gentleman has expired. Ms. Sewell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank both of our witnesses for being here today. I'd like to turn our discussion to the campaign to remove career diplomat Ambassador Yovanovitch. Both of you, in your various capacities, had to work with her, and both of you witnessed what I would call a smear campaign. I wanted to know your thoughts, Dr. Hill. What was your view of Ambassador Yovanovitch's experience and quality of her work in the Ukraine, and what and do you consider it to be a smear campaign?
I have the highest regard for Ambassador Yovanovitch, both in terms of her integrity and the high standards of work that she was carrying out as ambassador in Ukraine and across her whole career. I do believe that there was a smear campaign, and I just want to say again for the record that I think it was unnecessary. If there was a decision to have a political ambassador put in place in Ukraine, that would be perfectly acceptable. It's exactly the right of the president to be able to do that. I did not see why it was necessary to malign Ambassador Yovanovitch to such an extent.
Mr. Holmes, would you agree with that? And can you talk about the character, integrity, and performance of Ambassador Yovanovitch, both in Ukraine?
Yes, ma'am. She was extremely professional, respected in Ukraine by Ukrainians, I think also by visiting American senior officials, including members of this committee and of Congress who came to visit. She extremely dedicated, hardworking.
Did you see it as a smear campaign as well?
I did, yes.
And what was the effect that it had on the morale of other professionals that you worked with in the Ukraine?
It was a very confusing time. As I've said before, the president has the right to remove an ambassador for any or no reason at all. It was not clear to us why this was happening or why people weren't standing up for her.
I'd like to now turn, Dr. Hill, to your boss. Your boss was Ambassador Bolton, right?
That's correct, yes.
Did your boss, Ambassador Bolton, tell you that Giuliani was, quote, a hand grenade?
He did, yes.
What do you think he meant by his characterization of Giuliani as a hand grenade?
What he meant by this was pretty clear to me in the context of all of the statements that Mr. Giuliani was making publicly, that the investigations that he was promoting, that the storyline he was promoting, the narrative of he was promoting was going to backfire. I think it has backfired.
Was that narrative also inclusive of falsehoods about Ambassador Yovanovitch?
At the particular juncture that Ambassador Bolton made that comment, absolutely, because that was in the context of my discussions with him about what was happening to Ambassador Yovanovitch.
I was particularly struck by your testimony, Dr. Hill, about receiving hateful calls and being accused of being a Soros mole in the White House. Are you a never-Trumper, or have you been true to your profession and remain nonpartisan?
I honestly don't know what the definition of a never-Trumper is, as I think many of my colleagues are feeling the same way, that it's a puzzling term to be applied to career or nonpartisan officials. And I chose to come into the administration. I could easily have said no when I was approached.
Yes, but you didn't sign up to have hateful calls and the like.
I guess, unfortunately, where we are today in America, that's coming with the territory. They're continuing, honestly. I mean, we're constantly having to block Twitter posts of my name and address and on the Internet. We've been doing this over the last couple of days.
I think that
as I said in my deposition, this could happen to any single person in this room, be it members of the press, be it members of Congress, and be it the staff. And I think we have to find ways of combating this. And again, this gets back, sadly, to things that our adversaries can also exploit.
Exactly. I think you would agree with me that this shouldn't become the new normal. Would you agree?
It should not.
I also think that this kind of behavior, instead of keeping you down, would make you undeterred. Are you more determined to continue to do your work and to do it professionally?
I am, and I think that all my colleagues are as well, because just as you said, we can't let this stand, and I don't think anyone here wants to let this stand. I actually don't believe that this is a partisan issue. I don't think anybody wants to come under personal attack.
Yeah, I unfortunately think that this has become the new norm, and we're being led by the very top of the food chain, which is our president, which is unfortunate. I'm especially disheartened by his treatment of women, and I think that the fact of the matter is that there's a long line of strong, talented women who have been smeared and victimized by this president, and we can either choose to ignore it or do something about it. And frankly, I think that whether you voted for him or whether you supported him or not, that doing so is wrong. You could simply just remove someone. You don't have to smear them. Thank you, and I yield back my time.
Mr. Turner.
Right. I just want to echo that sentiment and certainly lament the attacks that have been levied against our colleague Lee Stefanik on this panel, which have been vile and hateful. For those of you keeping score at home, the effort to accuse our president of coercion, extortion, or bribery with these witnesses as we now come to the closing session of this basically break down as follows. We have Kent and Ambassador Taylor, who spoke of hearsay. Their hearsay of these matters that they said that they had heard were all statements that they'd heard from others who have also testified in front of us. So there's no one that's missing. There's no one out there. Kent and Taylor basically said that they'd heard it from Morrison and Sondland. Morrison indicated he'd heard it from Sondland. Sondland testified yesterday he'd heard it from no one on the planet. Vindman and Morrison both have direct testimony of the phone call with the President of the United States. Beyond that, they only had contact with Sondland, and again, Sondland indicated he had contact with no one on the planet. Volker testified that he did have direct contact both with the Ukrainians and with the President of the United States, and indicated that the President of the United States did not condition either a phone call, a meeting, or aid upon Ukraine undertaking investigations, and also testified that the Ukrainians did not believe that either. We also have the direct statements from the President of Ukraine and the Foreign Minister that they did not feel any pressure to undertake investigations, and we also have the evidence that we're all very much aware of, which is they did not undertake any investigations. We also have Yovanovitch and Dr. Hill. Yovanovitch obviously left before the time period. Dr. Hill, we appreciate your being with us today, and Mr. Holmes. Dr. Hill, you have provided me probably the greatest piece of evidence that's before us to illustrate the problem with hearsay. So you said, based on questions and statements, I have heard some of you on this committee, that'd be us, appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country. And perhaps somehow, for some reason, it was Ukraine. So this is was held up by Devin Nunes. This is the report on Russian active measures that was voted on by all of us. It begins with this sentence. In 2015, Russia began engaging in a covert influence campaign aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Every one of us, little, small, effort on your part, Dr. Hill, and you would have known that what you just said was not true, what you had heard, but you felt the need to put it in your 8-page statement before you went on to tell us a bunch of other things that you heard about other people, no matter how convinced you were of, also which were not necessarily true. One of which was that you said that Ambassador Sondland met with Giuliani. Actually, Ambassador Sondland testified here that he had not, as ambassador, met with Giuliani. He'd briefly met him in his lifetime by shaking his hand. And Giuliani issued a statement that they had never met either. This is the problem with, no matter how convinced we are, Dr. Hill, no matter how much we believe we know that what we've heard is true, it is still just what we've heard. But so far in this hearing, in this series of hearings, the only thing that we have is Volker saying, I spoke to the president, and I've spoke to the Ukrainians, neither of which believed that aid was conditioned, neither of which believed that the president was requiring it. And Ambassador Sondland, which said no one on the planet told him that that was the case. That's the sole evidence. Now, I got to tell you, the one thing that's interesting is Ambassador Sondland did say it's his belief that a meeting with the president was conditioned upon investigations. Ambassador Volker, who I think is a man of very significant integrity, said that that was not the case. Now, even if Ambassador Sondland is correct that somebody, and Dr. Hill, you testified, and again, it's hearsay, you don't know, that supposedly Mulvaney told him that, because he didn't testify to that. But let's say somebody beside the president told him that. You guys want to be the laughingstock of history to impeach a president of the United States because he didn't take a meeting? Oh, please, dear God. Please undertake that. Now, Mr. Holmes, I got to tell you,
Is there a question for Dr. Hill?
Mr. Holmes, in your testimony, you said that Sondland said he loves your ass and also said he'll do anything that you want. Mm-hmm. Mr. Holmes, that information had nothing whatsoever to do with the subject matter of any of these hearings. It was anecdotal. It was extraneous. Your statements that your interests are protecting Ukraine are very dubious when you embarrass President Zelensky by making those statements that you didn't have to make. Who cares that Ambassador Sondland said that? And you know you didn't embarrass Ambassador Sondland, you embarrassed Zelensky, because you know he got asked this question in his own country, and people are hearing that statement as if it's
true. Time of the gentleman has expired.
It's totally dubious of you to do that.
Mr. Carson, you are recognized.
I yield back.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you both for your service. Dr. Hill, I'd like to talk a little bit more in depth about Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's role in the events under investigation. You testified, ma'am, that Mr. Mulvaney and Ambassador Sondland were both involved with a letter President Trump sent to the Ukrainian president on May 29th, congratulating him on his inauguration. Do you recall that, ma'am?
I did, yes.
And towards the end of that letter, President Trump closed with, quote, "I would like to invite you to meet me at the White House in Washington, D.C. as soon as we can find a mutually convenient time," end quote. Dr. Hill, was this congratulatory letter drafted through the normal procedures at the NSC? That the NSC uses to send letters to foreign heads of state?
The first part of it was, except the last paragraph.
You also testified that Ambassador Sondland told you that he had dictated that line to the president, and that he told Mr. Mulvaney to add that to the letter. Is that correct, ma'am?
That's correct.
You said that you were nervous about that. Why were you nervous, Dr. Hill?
Because at this juncture, it had become quite apparent that the president wasn't very keen on having a meeting with Mr. Zelensky for all the reasons that we've been trying to lay out today. And we were, once one puts in a letter like that, you raise the expectation of an invitation coming shortly.
Dr. Hill, you also testified, ma'am, that Ambassador Sondland was frequently meeting with Mr. Mulvaney. Mr. Giuliani's campaign of lies ultimately led to Ambassador Yovanovitch being recalled from her post in April 2019. You've also testified, ma'am, that her removal was pretty dispiriting and a turning point for you. Can you explain to us why, ma'am?
Well, again, as we've all made clear, Ambassador Yovanovitch, and you saw for yourselves in her deposition, is a person of great integrity. She's one of our finest Foreign Service officers, career Foreign Service officers. And this had been a decision to remove her, to replace her with a political appointee. Again, that is perfectly within the rights of the president. Sometimes it's highly advisable, in fact, to emphasize to a country just exactly how close the relationship is likely to be, to have an appointee who is close to the president if it's an important relationship. But what was dispiriting was all of the accusations that were being fired at Ambassador Yovanovitch, leading her to be tweeted, including by members of the president's family. We all firmly believed that Mr. Giuliani and others, including the people who were recently indicted, the Ukrainian American gentleman, had for some reason decided that Ambassador Yovanovitch was some kind of personal problem for them. And that they had then decided to engage in just the kinds of things we've been discussing about. And frankly, she was an easy target as a woman. And I'm very sorry to hear about what's happened to Congressman Stefanik. And I think that this just illustrates the point and the problem that we're dealing with here today.
Certainly. I was also struck by your testimony that you were also the target of false accusations during your time in the Trump administration. You testified, ma'am, about receiving hateful calls and being accused of being, quote, a mole in the White House. You testified about death threats and calls at your home. Is that right?
That's correct. That was in 2017.
Well, I'm sorry you've had to go through all of this, ma'am. You don't strike me as a woman who is easily deterred. You're not easily deterred, are you, Dr. Hill?
I'm not, no.
Thank you both for your service. I yield back, Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
I thank the gentleman for yielding. Just another fact check, and again, my caution to both of you that representations about what prior witnesses said or what you have even said may not be consistent with the facts. This was from Ambassador Sondland's opening statement. After the Zelensky meeting, I also met with Zelensky's senior aide, Andrei Yermak. I don't recall the specifics of our conversation, but I believe the issue of investigations was probably a part of that agenda or meeting. Now recognize Dr. Wenstrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you both for being here. You know, in 1998, I voluntarily joined the United States Army Reserve because I saw our country under attack time and time again. Bill Clinton was the president. I didn't vote for Bill Clinton, but he was my commander-in-chief. It didn't matter that I didn't vote for him. I'm grateful to live in a country that gets to legitimately elect our leaders. And I've been to places where people don't get to, and it's not pretty. And I respect our system, and I accept the results that are determined by the American people. I deployed to Iraq 2005-2006 as an Army surgeon with soldiers from many backgrounds. The most important thing was we were all Americans. That was first and foremost. In our mission, we treated our troops, we treated the enemy, winning over the hearts and minds of people that never knew us because of their dictator, Saddam Hussein, who told them that we were responsible for all their problems, and that was his narrative. And speaking of narratives, Dr. Hill, I'm sorry, I have to say this. You said, based on statements you've heard, that some in this committee believe Russia did not conduct a campaign against our country is false. That's Mr. Schiff's narrative. That's where you've heard it. We did a whole report on it. And we agree that Russia has done this since the Soviet Union, and they've actually gotten better at it. That's a problem. But at the same time, certain Ukrainians did work against candidate Trump, some with the DNC. And if that's debunked, why is it Mr. Schiff has denied DNC operative Alexandra Chalupa from testifying to come forward and debunk it? I ask America, was it good for the country for the DNC and the Clinton campaign to pay Christopher Steele to dig up fake dirt with other foreign service sources on their political rival? Was it good for America to claim having evidence of the president colluding with Russians when he did not, costing the taxpayer millions and being debunked by special counsel? I'd say the false narrative got caught. Was it good for the country, for Americans and foreigners alike, to attempt to entrap members of a United States presidential campaign, specifically the Trump campaign? Sadly, I've come to believe through all this that some in power do think it's good. They think it's okay. And now we're here in an impeachment proceeding, certainly a right that Congress has, and apparently even with very partisan rules. But I'm curious. This impeachment inquiry was announced by the Speaker before the whistleblower complaint was even out. I'm curious why the lawyer for the whistleblower announced that the coup to impeach the president, that he announced that right after Trump won. That's pretty damning. I know it hurts after losing an election, especially as Americans, we usually get over it. And I imagine it would hurt even more if you were promised a position in the next administration and lost, and your hopes and your dreams are dashed. You know, I've seen hatred for political reasons, specifically on June 14, 2017, at a ball field in Virginia. And I've seen hatred in war. And I know that hatred blinds people. I've been in war, and I've studied war. And coups create division. And it's time for this phase of the publicly announced and proclaimed Democrat coup to end. Thank you for your service. Thanks for being here. And I yield back.
Could I actually say something? Because we've had three...
Doctor, I was going to ask you if you'd like to respond. There have been a number...
I
General Suspend, Dr. Hill, you may respond.
No, I think that what Dr. Wenstrup said was very powerful about the importance of overcoming hatred and certainly partisan division. And it's unfortunate that Congressmen Turner and Ratcliffe have both left as well. Because I think all of us who came here under a legal obligation also felt we had a moral obligation to do so. We came as fact witnesses. When I was referring to questions that I'd heard, it was in the context of the deposition that I gave on October 14th, because I was very worried about the turn in which some of the questions were taking. And I understand that the point is being made about individuals, as you've just said, Dr. Wenstrup, and that these articles lay out taking different positions in our elections. I don't believe that there should be any interference of any kind in our election. I think it was unfair for people to already call the election and to make attacks also on candidate Trump and on President Trump. And I know that this has put a huge cloud over this presidency and also over our whole democratic system. That's actually why, as a non-partisan person, and as an expert on Russia, and an expert on Vladimir Putin and on the Russian security services, I wanted to come in to serve the country to try to see if I could help. I heard President Trump say that he wanted to improve the relations with Russia. I believe we have to. We can't be in this unending confrontation with Russia. We have to find a way to stabilize that relationship and to professionalize that relationship, as well as to stop them from doing what they did in 2016 again in 2020. This is really the crux of the issue that I and others are trying to put across, and I think that you've put across very eloquently. The other matters related to this inquiry, we're here just to provide what we know and what we've heard. I understand that for many members this may be hearsay. I've talked about things I heard with my own ears. I understand that Ambassador Sondland has said a lot of things. I've told you what he told me and what others told me. A lot of other people have said things to me again as well, and also to Mr. Holmes, and we're here to relate to you what we heard, what we saw, and what we did, and to be of some help to all of you in really making a very momentous decision here. We are not the people who make that decision. And I do, again, want to underscore what you said here, Dr. Wenstrup. It was very eloquent and very moving about your service, and trying to bring us all together again as Americans. We need to be together again in 2020 so the American people can make a choice about the future and about make their vote in a presidential election without any fear that this is being interfered in by from any quarter whatsoever. So I just want to thank you for making what I think was also a very elegant and eloquent and heartfelt defense.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. Ms. Spear.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Dr. Hill, Mr. Holmes, thank you both for being fact witnesses. We are here as fact finders, and we appreciate very much your presentations. Dr. Hill, I want to verify this story. I understand that when you were 11 years old, there was a schoolboy who set your pigtails on fire, and you were taking a test. You turned around and with your hands snuffed out the fire and then proceeded to finish your test. Is that a true story?
It is a true story. I was a bit surprised to see that pop up today. It's one of the stories I occasionally tell because it had some very unfortunate consequences afterwards. My mother gave me a bowl haircut. So for the school photograph later in that week, I look like Richard III, or as if I'm going to be in a permanent...
Well, I think it underscores the fact that you speak truth, that you are steely, and I truly respect that. Let me move to your testimony and your deposition. You had indicated you were deeply troubled by Ambassador Yovanovitch's the attacks on her, and you underscored again today that all ambassadors serve at the pleasure of the president. And certainly in the case of Ambassador Yovanovitch, he could have just asked her to come home. But that didn't happen. In fact, there was a systematic character assassination that went on. It went on from 2018, if I'm not mistaken. But you say, and the most obvious explanation at this point, it has to be said, seemed to be business dealings of individuals who wanted to improve their investment positions inside of Ukraine itself.
You were then asked, who do you understand was responsible for her removal? And you said, I understand this to be the result of the campaign that really Mr. Giuliani had set in motion in conjunction with people who were writing articles and, you know, publications that I would have expected better of. And also, you know, just the constant drumbeat of these accusations that he was making on the television. So, Rudy Giuliani was playing fast and furious in Ukraine, it would appear. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And he had no official tasking within the administration. Is that correct?
Not that I had been told of.
But he frequently met with Ukrainian officials to request that they open an investigation.
So I was led to understand, yes.
You testified that Mr. Giuliani's involvement was, quote, a massive complication in terms of our engagement with Ukraine.
That's correct.
Would you like to explain that?
Well, I think I already laid that out in earlier part of response to some of the questions. We were actually conducting, which, you know, for a lot of the American people might seem to be a rather boring, standard bilateral policy toward Ukraine, pushing them on issues of reform in the energy sector and more broadly. We were concerned, obviously, about corruption in Ukraine. We were trying to help Ukraine regain its sovereignty after the attacks by Russia.
So how did Mr. Giuliani's involvement affect?
Well, we basically had worked out over a course of 2 years and in conjunction, close conjunction with the embassy in Kiev, an interagency agreed action plan. And these are things that, in fact, Colonel Vindman and others were working on, basically moving forward on the various issues that were on the list of items. Clearly, Rudy Giuliani and other people didn't care at all about this.
All right.
Clearly, Ambassador Sondland wasn't particularly interested in it either. It's quite boring. It wouldn't make for good copy in the press. And it's the kind of thing that everybody in a routine moves forward on.
Mr. Holmes, you talked about the extraordinary power that Russia tries to assert against Ukraine. So since President Zelensky never got his White House meeting, doesn't that make Ukraine look weak, and doesn't that benefit Russia?
Absolutely.
All right. So promoting Putin's false claim of Ukraine intervention into the U.S. election also benefits Russia, doesn't it?
It does.
So when President Trump meets privately with Vladimir Putin at the G20 summit, who does that benefit?
Well, it doesn't help Ukraine.
It doesn't help Ukraine. And by President Trump calling Ukraine corrupt and not North Korea, for instance, does that accrue to Russia's benefit?
Again, it doesn't help Ukraine.
All right. I thank you, and Mr. Chairman, I'll yield the rest of my time to you.
You're yielding me 3 seconds. Not even I can make use of 3 seconds. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. Dr. Hill, Ms. Holmes, thank you for being here. I actually have no questions for you that haven't already been asked or made any points that haven't already been made. And I guess I'll just conclude by something I've said before. This Impeachapalooza tour finally comes to an end. I mean, a year of resistance, 2.5 years of these absurd accusations against the president of Russian collusion. We've gone from quid pro quo to bribery to extortion, 7 weeks of hearings, 16 secret closed-door sessions, 12 public hearings now, of which you are the last, hundreds of hours of testimony. And I really think that for those who hate the president, they haven't changed their minds. But there's a lot of Americans who look at this and they think, is that it, really? You're going to impeach and remove a president for this? Now, like I said, if you don't like the president, you've already come to that conclusion. Many people wanted this 3 years ago. But for a lot of Americans, they really look at that, and they can see this. No evidence, zero evidence of any bribery, zero evidence of extortion, zero evidence firsthand of any quid pro quo. And yet, impeachment is almost inevitable. And why? Because the leadership of this committee has been unfair and dishonest. And I know we hear these crocodile tears from some of my colleagues who are heartbroken, because they finally have to impeach this president. And we know that's absurd. There's no heartbroken. There's no prayerful tears over this. They're giddy over this. And there's not a person in the country who doesn't know that. Everyone knows what they're going to do next. They're going to impeach the president, and they're going to send it on to the Senate. But that is the good news. That's good news. You know, we've all been to a concert. You got the warm-up band, and then you got the main act. And what we've seen here is the warm-up band. This is kind of like the Sioux City Crooners. This is a band that no one's ever heard of. But the warm-up band is over, and now we're going to go on to the main event, and that's in the U.S. Senate. And in the U.S. Senate, there won't be any secret testimony. There's not going to be dishonest leadership or a chairman who refuses to let us ask appropriate questions or to deny a defense. Where in the world, where in the country do you have a trial where the prosecution presents their case and the defense isn't able to? So we'll finally be able to get to the truth. So I'm talking now to my colleagues in the Senate. These are some of the witnesses that you need to call, and these are some of the questions that you need to ask. First, you have to hear from the whistleblower. Now, they can choose to do that in closed session if they want to. I leave that up to them. But you can't initiate an impeachment of the President of the United States and not have to answer some questions. Who did he get his information from? Did he have the classification and the clearances to get that information? What's his relationship with Vice President Biden? Who has he shared that information with, including some members of the committee here? I think our own chairman needs to be called. What interactions did he or his staff have with the whistleblower? Did they help to coordinate or in any way facilitate the complaint? Did they coordinate and facilitate him counsel? What about Hunter Biden? How did he get his job? What did he do to earn his salary? And here's the key to this. Look, if he goes there and makes money, knock yourself out. I don't care. But I want to know, did he have officials with or conversations with government officials? And was government policy changed at a particularly high level because of some of those? Devin Archer, former board member from Burisma. Alexandria Chalupa, former DNC official who admitted she provided anti-Trump information to the DNC and to Hillary Clinton. Nellie Orr from Fusion GPS, who helped to create the ridiculous Steele dossier. I'd like to remind us what I said yesterday. The American people expect a lot in politics. They understand the tussle, the fight, the debate, but they also expect basic fairness. And these proceedings have been anything but fair. The Senate has an opportunity to fix that. I am confident they will. And I look forward to them completing the job that we could have done here. And with that, I will yield back.
Mr. Quigley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you both for being here. Dr. Hill, when we last left July 10th, I believe Ambassador Bolton said to you, you go and tell Eisenberg that I am not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this, and you go tell him what you heard and what I've said. That's correct, is that right?
That's correct, sir, yes.
And John Eisenberg, he's the chief lawyer for the National Security Council, correct?
He is, yes.
And you went to see him?
I did go to see him.
And what did you say to him that day?
I basically gave him the same summary that I've given to you on the 10th of July.
Of what took place?
Of what took place, correct. Including some of the details that I shared with you as well, the sequencing and what transpired as I was walking in.
Now, did you have one or two meetings with him about that?
He did not have a great deal of time on the 10th, and I gave him the quick summary, and we agreed that we would meet again on the 11th, on July 11th, the next day. And I also wanted to bring in with me my colleague, Wells Griffith, our senior director for energy, who'd been sitting with me on the sofa for the first portion of the meeting. And I also suggested that he speak to Colonel Vindman separately as well, because Colonel Vindman was in the wardroom when I arrived and had obviously been engaged in some discussion before I got there, because as I got into the room, they were clearly in the course of, sorry, with the microphone, clearly in the course of conversation. And I thought it was important for John Eisenberg to hear from Colonel Vindman himself what his recollections of the meeting were.
Did you raise the concerns that Ambassador Bolton had raised to you, to Mr. Eisenberg?
I certainly did. The first thing I related to him was exactly and precisely what Ambassador Bolton had asked me to.
In the course of those two meetings, what was Mr. Eisenberg's response?
Mr. Eisenberg took it all very seriously. He said, for example, that Colonel Vindman should feel free, he said this to me, in future to go and bring any concerns to him about these meetings. Similarly, myself and any others, if there was any subsequent follow-up in terms of these issues being raised again with any of the parties in the future.
He didn't say anything in response about how he took that meeting, how he would describe it, or if he had any, did he raise any concerns about what you told him that took place?
No, he did not. He listened very carefully to all of the information that we imparted.
Now, back to that July 10th meeting, the second meeting that's in the wardroom, correct?
That's correct.
Now, who's in that meeting besides yourself, the two Ukrainians?
Mr. Danilyuk, Mr. Yermak, Mr. Yermak's aide, Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, and then a couple of people who I think were from the State Department. I wondered for a while if one of Secretary Perry's group had been there too.
But
I honestly cannot remember.
But Ambassador Volker was there during that entire...
He was there, but he didn't actually speak very much during that meeting. And I heard his deposition, and I read his deposition, where he didn't really recall that encounter. Again, he didn't really speak. Ambassador Sondland was doing most of the speaking.
Yeah, and as you, I think you described it as you came in... Ambassador Sondland was talking about how he had an agreement with Chief of Staff Mulvaney for a meeting with the Ukrainians if they were going forward with the investigations. While this was taking place and afterwards, how were the Ukrainians reacting to what was being said?
Well, at the time, Mr. Yermak was quite impassive. I said that he had an aide with him, and his aide was sitting next to him in the original meeting with Ambassador Bolton and was, you know, from time to time, actually was on this side, whispering to him. So I wasn't sure myself, because I had not met Mr. Yarmouth before, about how good his English was. So I wasn't sure, perhaps Mr. Holmes might be able to reflect on that, as to whether he was, you know, having some points of clarification from the aide.
He understood what was happening.
Yeah, so I wasn't entirely sure if he was following all of the back and forth. Mr. Danilyuk, who I know very well and speaks very good English, looked quite alarmed. I think he was more alarmed at the fact that there was this back and forth between Ambassador Sondland and Colonel Vindman than with me about the meeting. Clearly, they very much wanted to have this meeting, and here are some U.S. officials arguing about the meeting in front of him, and that was obviously very uncomfortable for him.
Did you have any follow-up to that, sir?
Just to add that Danilyuk speaks perfect English, and Yermak can get by in meetings, but often does ask for clarifications.
Given the time, I would yield back.
Ms. Stefanik.
Before I turn to our witnesses, I just wanted to say to my Democratic colleagues, not a single Republican member of this committee has said that Russia did not meddle in the 2016 elections. As the ranking member stated, we published a report focused on Russian active measures in 2016 with policy recommendations as to how we strengthen our cyber resiliency and election security to counter Russia. I myself have worked with members of this very committee on this issue, but also on the House Armed Services Committee. So to have our Democratic colleagues say these untruthful statements just reeks of political desperation in their continued obsession to manipulate mainstream media coverage. But the good news is the American people understand that this has been a partisan process from the start. The Democratic coordination with the whistleblower, the incessant and astounding leaks, the unprecedented closed-door process, closed to the majority of members, closed to the press, closed to the people, starting this inquiry without taking a vote, and then when finally forced to take a vote, the vote was with bipartisan opposition. Now, with 4 minutes left, I'm going to turn to our two witnesses. Thank you both for your service. Thank you, Dr. Hill, for your comments on the personal attacks. I wanted to ask you each fact-based questions. Dr. Hill, you testified that you handed over your duties on the NSC to Tim Morrison on July 15th and that you physically left the White House on July 19th, correct?
That is correct, yes.
So that means that by the time there was the July 25th call with President Trump and President Zelensky, you were no longer on the NSC, correct?
Actually, I was still technically on the payroll of the NSC until the end of August, August 30th of 2019. But I was not physically in the building, and I'd handed over my duties to Mr. Morrison.
And you were not on the call?
I was not on the call. That is absolutely correct.
And it's also correct that you did not participate in the preparation of talking points or the specific coordination of setting up the call?
Not for that call, but let me just say for the record that there had been a long anticipation that eventually there would be a call. So there was a call package that was prepared in advance. I just cannot say how much of that call package that had perhaps been prepared since, for example, the inauguration of President Zelensky was then used as the basic material for that call. So I did take part in the preparation of that standard call package, but I did not take part in any preparation for the specific call on July 25th.
And the first time you actually read the transcript of the call was when it was released to the public.
That's correct.
Mr. Holmes, I wanted to turn to you. Good to see you again. Thank you for mentioning the bipartisan delegation that I led on behalf of the House Armed Services Committee with my friend, Representative Anthony Brown from Maryland. We did have an exceptionally informative visit where we highlighted the bipartisan congressional support for Ukraine, in particular the importance of countering Russian aggression. And we discussed in the briefings at the embassy the importance of defensive lethal aid in the form of javelin, which, as you both, I think you stated today, is, quote, an important strategic deterrent to Russia. And I just want to highlight on the record, I know this has been asked, the javelins were provided by the Trump administration and not the Obama administration, correct?
That's correct. And I would just say, I think we discussed the importance of all our security assistance to Ukraine, not just the javelin.
Absolutely. All of our security assistance, which I strongly support. Again, thank you for being a host on that. Dr. Hill, turning back to you, there's been discussion about the process of scheduling the meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump. And you testified that there was hesitancy to schedule this meeting until after the Ukrainian parliamentary elections. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And that's because there was speculation in all analytical circles, both in Ukraine and outside the Ukraine, that Zelensky might not be able to get the majority that he needed to form a cabinet, correct?
That is correct.
And you also testified that another aspect of the NSC's hesitancy to schedule this meeting was based on broader concerns related to Zelensky's ability to implement anti-corruption reforms. And this was in specific relation to Ukrainian oligarchs who basically were the owner of the TV company that Mr. Zelensky's program had been a part of. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You know, just distilling this down to the key facts, I wanted to ask both of you three key questions. So the fact of the matter is Ukraine ultimately did receive the aid, correct, Mr. Holmes?
Ultimately.
Yes. And Dr. Hill?
Correct, ultimately.
And there was no investigation into the Bidens, correct, Mr. Holmes?
They did not open a new investigation into the Bidens.
No. Correct. And Dr. Hill?
Correct.
And there was, in fact, a meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky ultimately at the UN. Is that correct?
The president invited Zelensky to the Oval Office at a date undetermined. That has not yet happened.
The meeting at the UN. President Trump and President Zelensky met at the UN.
They did, but not in the Oval Office.
But they did have a meeting at the UN.
They did, ma'am.
And Dr. Hill, they did. Okay, thank you. I yield back.